Hey, good afternoon, Steele. How you doing?
Great, Dave.
Are you ready for another episode?
Dave, I could not be more ready.
Welcome to Off the Chain. We're glad you decided to join us. We got some awesome stuff to talk about this week. We're going to talk about aliens this week, Steele. I know you're excited. Steele actually has someone that he's going to induct to the Off the Chain Hall of Fame. It's a really exclusive group, and we're going to invite a new member in this time. We're going to do a Lost the Plot segment, one of my favorite segments, where Steele has to try and guess the plot of an awesome action movie. And like always, we got some songs for you, Unchained Melodies, and we're going to finish up with some book wisdom. Before we even talk about aliens, Steele, I want to get your thoughts on this. So,
okay.
So recently I got a haircut.
Ooh.
You know, I got a little buzz cut. I usually have kind of long, floppy hair that's all over the place. And people have been falling all over themselves to compliment my haircut. Like at work, church, family, everyone's just like keeps telling me how great the haircut is. And it honestly, it irritates me a little bit.
Because you're like, I just used to have hair that was also great, but no one noticed. They only notice when it's gone. No
Is
one...
that wrong to be kind of irritated by compliments? Essentially, I'm taking them as like, hey, Dave, your last hairstyle was terrible.
Because that's what it is, Dave. Some compliments are sincere, but I'll just say it this way. It's very rare that someone is giving like a legit, sincere compliment for a male's haircut. It's like usually just passes unnoticed. If they're complimenting a man's haircut, if they have an extraordinary haircut, then I understand. But if it's like a buzz cut, what they're really complimenting is the transition from the old haircut. They're like, I'm proud that you got rid of whatever rat's nest you used to have. That's what, like, to say to a man, hey, I love your haircut, means thanks for finally doing something about the disaster you used to have. And it's okay to get upset about that, because that's not very nice. That's like a passive-aggressive, backhanded compliment. And there's no room for those.
No.
Some
I'll shoot down, and others, but yeah. I've gotten upwards of 20 compliments over the top about this haircut. And it's made me mad. I want to, like, get a mohawk now or something, Steve.
And that's the thing where if everybody's complimenting, like, a long hair choice, you could be like, fine, I'll spite him. I'll cut it off. But when you went the other way, you're powerless to do anything about it. You just got to wait. Or get a wig,
yeah,
Dave. You could get a wig.
I'll think about it. So that's where I'm at this week, Steve. I got a haircut that everybody loves. And
it's pissing
me
off.
I've got a subject that I think is off the chain, aliens.
That's great.
So I love aliens, Steele, and I've been thinking about them a lot lately because I've been reading a lot of science fiction. I've come up with four basic categories of aliens that we get in fiction that I think are awesome. I want to run these by you. I want to kind of see what you think and maybe figure out what category might be your favorite.
Okay.
So one, I've got lovable.
Lovable aliens.
Two, I've got frightening.
Yeah, definitely.
Three, I've got kidnappers.
Okay.
And four, I've got weird intelligent beings.
Yeah, so there's some overlap occasionally.
A little bit, but like, can you define what I'm saying with these categories?
Yeah, definitely. So like lovable aliens, of course. This is the benign, the benevolent, the non-threatening, and they often come and they're like, we come in peace, and they're going to show us a better way to live, or they're just going to be like pets that come from another planet, basically. And it's often like the children of that species, and when the parents arrive, they could be in class 2 or class 4, we're not really sure, but the kids were sure lovable.
Basically, this category makes up a lot of 80s films, but we're talking E.T., is certainly unlovable. And usually they're going to give you some type of magic power or wisdom as well.
Definitely.
But so E.T. does it. You got Chewbacca, Ewoks.
Oh, yeah.
Star Wars is just full of like aliens you want to hug and give them like a kiss or something. That's your lovable alien.
How about Alf? Where would you put Alf? I guess he's probably category 4.
No. Alf is certainly a lovable alien. Everyone loves Alf. He eats cats. It's hilarious.
That is hilarious. That could only fly in the 80s because people love their cats so much now. There'd be so much of an uproar. I guess cats don't really... Do they roar? I don't know.
No, that'd have been a better joke. The pet owners would. The pet owners would.
People would be howling about that. Oh, what do cats do? Meow? I can't think of a meow pun. But anyway.
No. So basically, if you want to give a hug to this alien and they're going to make you a sandwich or something, they're lovable.
Yeah.
So what would you think frightening? What would you do there? Geez.
This is like the trope of 90s action films. Or 2000s. Yeah. Like Independence Day or Alien. Anything that has alien in the name is generally going to be terrifying. They're often insect-like in appearance. They have super advanced technology. They just want to murderize stuff.
Yeah,
these subjugate it.
They have no soul. They don't really seem to have a heart. I don't know if insects have hearts. I assume they don't because of these aliens. You got your predator that comes here just to try and kill Arnold Schwarzenegger. These things are terrible. The only thing that they really know is I want to kill a human being. That's what they're there for.
Yeah, and I would say there's generally two things that I've noticed about the frightening type of alien. One is there's not a lot of variety in clothing. If there's a horde of them, it's not like any of them have individual fashion sense. And that's kind of disappointing because I imagine, well, I mean, it's just lack of imagination. But the other thing that you notice about them is very little aesthetic sense, especially with color. Like, they're just not using the full range of the color palette for frightening aliens.
No, they're going black, gray, and that's pretty much where you're going.
Yeah, it's pretty racist.
But, I mean, yeah, they don't wear many kinds of clothing. But I think as what I've learned from science fiction in general is as civilizations advance and technology comes to some wonderful culmination, we dress alike more and more within that society.
Yeah. That's true. Like Bill and Ted's, I'm thinking of the perfect example, the robes, metallic robes.
Yeah, so I don't know if you can hold that against these aliens, because I think that's just a universal thing that happens to a race as you progress with technology. You just all wear the same clothing.
And you develop a stronger, more powerful exoskeleton. Those are the two things that happen. So
that's the frightening ones. They're terrifying.
Large eyes, big teeth.
But the next one is definitely different. The kidnappers. What do you think about this group?
These are the ones that are not based in fiction, I assume. These are the real ones that visit us and kidnap people. Because you hear the reports.
This is your fire in the sky kidnapping. They've taken you onto their ship. You may not remember it well, but they are putting something in your rectum. And they are going to return you to Earth. And you're a changed person.
So, Dave, how much of these alien kidnappers are based on nurses as a profession? Like, is this like somebody has a drug-induced rectal tube inserted and they're like, it was aliens. I don't want to admit that I was in such a weak state that someone who was trained as a nurse had full control over my body.
Still, I think that's greatly underestimating the things that extraterrestrial beings can learn from inserting a probe in a man's rectum. So there may be some minor overlap between the two, but from what I understand, there is a lot that you can learn about a being by inserting a probe in the rectum.
So that's really, I mean, what else are human beings kidnapped by aliens for? It's as aliens are like, we have an insatiable rectal curiosity. Aliens don't seem to want to know anything else.
I think that as technology progresses, you figured everything else out. There's still the potty. You're still figuring out how to better explore waste. But this particular group of aliens, I mean, it's scary, but it's also somewhat benign. Like, they're going to make you weird the rest of your life, but they're not going to eat you.
It's true. And they generally sedate the people, too. They're not doing this as torture. It's science.
And curiosity.
Yeah.
I think that's something we all can understand. Now, the final group of aliens, which is a little bit more out there, less defined, is weird intelligent beings. Where do you think I'm coming with this category?
That's what I'm not sure about. I'm guessing this is probably from the realm of comic books.
This is science fiction.
Okay.
You read a science fiction book, just grab one off the shelf. There's going to be some weird alien race that you would never have thought of this alien race before. It's just, it's something weird, and they're intelligent. They're not necessarily going to kidnap you or kill you or give you a hug, but they might make you feel uncomfortable and help you learn something.
Is this a group that we discover? They're not necessarily out discovering us quite as actively.
They might even be avoiding us, or we just meet in our spaceships. So I'll give you a couple examples of them. There's a book called A Fire Upon the Deep, which is an awesome title, but not quite as awesome of a book. There's a race of aliens within this book that is, it's like a pack of dogs. Imagine like five dogs, and they're sharing one hive mind. They communicate through sound waves. Weird, intelligent being.
So I like this, Dave. This reminds me a little bit. I guess the trope is that if they're intelligent, they avoid contact with us in a way. Like, so they tend to be the ones that are like keeping their distance. They're peaceful and we go and ruin everything, but then we learn something from them. Is this kind of the idea for this group?
Yeah, probably the defining race I'm thinking about is, because I've been reading this book, is a puppeteer. So what this basically is imagine something with two arms. But the arms are actually heads. There's an eye on each arm. I'm making motions.
No, this is great. I wish you could see the video at home. This is great. Keep going, Dave.
And so they're called puppeteers because it looks like sock puppets.
Wow.
And they're coming out of like a large stumpy body, three legs. They've evolved from a herd species. So their deepest inseated instinct is to flee from danger. So they're super intelligent, but they're always fleeing from danger. So they flee from humans because we're erratic. But sometimes they will try and get a human to go face danger for them.
So this is from what book series?
This is Larry Niven. It's from Ringworld.
Ringworld. The puppeteers.
Yeah. You read books, there's any number of these weird alien races. There's like, you know, these it's super intelligent beings that are made of hydrogen gas that float through space. There's all sorts of stuff. Why do you think we as humans like to think about aliens so much? Why is that so intriguing?
You know, I had a conversation about this recently with my friend Jack when I was down in L.A. He was like, oh, yeah, there are definitely aliens. And I was like, you seem so sure about this. He's like, yeah, of course, there have to be aliens. It was not even a question for him. And I was like, I laughed a little bit. I thought he was joking. And he's like, no. And I was like, and you think they've contacted us? And he's like, yeah, he's an otherwise intelligent guy, not saying that it's not intelligent to believe in this, but I think part of it is, for him, he was like, think of the math. We're a tiny pinprick in the universe, and the universe is enormous. Mathematically, there has to be life elsewhere. And if there is life elsewhere, there has to be millions of kinds of life, and at least one of those kinds of life is probably smarter and more developed and more advanced than we are, and may have visited us. And from that perspective, I'm like, oh, okay, that's interesting. But the other kind of point of view, I think the reason why it's so much part of our imagination is that aliens represent, like for me, a canvas that we can just project absolute otherness onto, or enough otherness to make some kind of fear embodied or wish fulfillment embodied. Like a lot of people, like maybe their deep desire, I think of repressed sexuality, these men would like to be rectally probed. And so you have to project it onto this alien who made you an unwilling passive recipient. But really, that's like their dream sexual fantasy. Maybe I shouldn't be going there right now, but that's one of my thoughts, Dave.
I think it is interesting to project something completely different out there. That's what they do in these books with the weird intelligent beings, is they'll try and create something that we can't even really understand, like the motivations for these beings. The other three kinds, like, basically we can understand what a lovable alien's doing, or a frightening alien just wants to kill us, or a kidnapper just wants to probe our rectum. Like, we understand. But the weird, intelligent beings, we might not necessarily know where they're coming from. But I think it's really intriguing to people because there is a real possibility they're out there. I believe that there are aliens out there. I don't know that they've actually come to Earth. I don't know necessarily why they would or if they have the technology because it's so far. But with how big the universe is, there's life somewhere else. I don't know if it's intelligent or going to probe my rectum, but I think it's out there.
Like, I feel like the first three categories are like the standard aliens that I see in films. And the fourth one is different because I can't think of a great example from a film where this really happens. I think it's much more, I think what you're saying, this genre of maybe science fiction, but like a book universe that gives you time to develop a complex idea in a way that film doesn't often afford. I don't know if that's true, but are the examples from that fourth category you're thinking of coming from books primarily?
Yeah, only from books. Film, I think it'd be too hard to present some of these ideas because it takes a long time to build this alien race. I think a lot of it comes from very individual ideas. Lots of times, these large science fiction films, you have to be working with other people and present it in such a way that it'll be easily understandable. While in reality, aliens probably aren't going to be super understandable. They probably wouldn't all look exactly like us, and Chewbacca, you probably wouldn't actually be able to understand what he was saying.
Yeah, you need time for that unfamiliar to become less unfamiliar, and you just don't have that time. So you could do it maybe in like a TV show that was a serial show like Stargate or Star Trek or something like that.
But also the weird ones, like they kind of make me feel uncomfortable. Like
Yeah.
one reason I didn't like that Fire Upon the Deep book that much is I didn't like the dog mind thing. It made me uncomfortable. I wanted them to just be like little dogs that talk to me. But they were like doing weird stuff with multiple dogs.
Doing weird stuff with multiple dogs, Dave. That sounds like it. I'm uncomfortable with that too.
I want to finish this segment.
Okay.
Of those four categories, what's your favorite kind of alien? Do you have a favorite?
Well, if I have to pick favorite, I can't pick frightening or kidnappers. I mean, by definition, those would be my least favorite. I think actually, like, lovable aliens are nice and everything. But they just seem like pets to me. I think that category number four is the one I would say I'm most intrigued by. That's the one I'm thinking about most.
I think for me, my favorite, let's say, if I'm going to spend time with an alien, obviously I want it to be a lovable one. I want it to be an Ewok or Chewbacca, but that I think are most interesting. Yeah, it's the weird intelligent beings. Well, that's aliens. They're off the chain.
They are totally off the chain, Dave.
We're going to bring it back to planet Earth for one of my favorite things is when we're able to honor someone or something by inducting them into the Off the Chain Hall of Fame.
Yeah, Dave, this is actually it's connected to aliens, but not in the way that you think. So this is a woman that I read about recently in the Washington Post. I was just blown away. I was really humbled. I was amazed, and I was just so impressed with this woman and her dedication. You were talking last episode about the TV show Turning Point and these people that are dedicated to social causes. This was one of those people, and her story really moved me. The woman that I want to induct into the Off the Chain Hall of Fame today is a woman named Nora Sandigo. She lives in Miami and she is a lawyer by training, but what she has become the legal guardian for more than 800 children in the United States. And what happens is increasingly often when people are deported, they are what are called mixed status families. So the parents will be deported, but they'll report having at least one or more children who were born in the United States and so are citizens and are not in danger of being deported. So you have these minors, 100,000 or more, lose at least one parent to deportation every year.
Jeez.
And so what she has done is she has said, I will become the legal guardian for these children. She's basically, in part, helping to sponsor them and help make decisions regarding their future so that they can stay in the United States and receive the education and the lives that they had been experiencing before they lost their parents. Only two of those children live with her, but the other 800 or so, she's got this big dossier, these files, and she's trying to stay involved in their lives and to provide resources and to give them food and clothing and shelter and access to education. And all of these things. And this story follows her for a couple of days as she's going around and meeting these families who realize that one or more of the parents is facing deportation. They need to do something for the kids. And so she says, here's this option. I'll sign and become their guardian. And the parents and the family thinks about it and decides. And the part that really moved me was she responds and goes to visit this family, and the family says, "You came." You know, they're like moved that she would come, surprised that she would come. And she says, "Yeah, of course I would come. There was need and I came." And for me, this is like the highest possible human responsibility that we can have. Like, we see a need. There's some kind of call being made upon us. And we say, "Yeah, here I am. What do you need?"
So most of these children then are living with family members or with the parent that's still in the country. Is that accurate?
Yeah, often it's relatives or sometimes friends. And many of them, the people that they remain with, are also in the country illegally. So the people who they're remaining with can't take on legal custodianship because they don't have the status to do so. Okay. And or they fear being deported themselves if they say, "I'm going to become the parent of record." They're like, "Oh, who are you? Oh, wait, you don't have papers? You're deported too." So they need someone who has legal status to become the legal guardian. And so she's filling this void for hundreds and hundreds of people.
Jeez. Does she have like a wider plan or something she supports to help fix the situation?
Well, no, I don't think. I mean, she's clearly going to be involved with the law and activism around the law. But she's a volunteer. She's doing it at her own expense, not because she thinks she's capable of it or she's good at it, but because nobody else does it. Right now, the federal government doesn't track what happens to children of deported parents. And nobody's monitoring how many guardians exist or who they are or what's happening there. So it's this kind of blind spot. And she's just saying, "I'm going to fill it and do what I can." And it sounds exhausting. And it sounds like some of these children she sees every week and helps make decisions for them. Some of them she's met only once on the day the parents signed the paperwork. It's not going to stop. She's just doing this. She started only 5-6 years ago with the first child. It was like a friend of hers. It was the turning point story. A Peruvian friend had been detained and her American-born daughters were being referred to foster care.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, who would be better to care for them than this woman? And this woman, Nora Sandigo, she was separated from her parents when she was 17. She was fleeing Nicaragua, a wartime situation, and then had become involved in immigration reform. So, I mean, it's just an incredible story. She's one of my heroes. I mean, I'd like to be more like her in responding to the call of the neighborhood that I live in. What's the need around me? I want to see it, and I want to do something. So she was an inspiration. She's in my Hall of Fame.
It's amazing. I love when people see a need and they don't wait for someone else to fill it or complain about how there's this need that exists or write a letter to their congressman even, but step in and do it. It's very inspiring. And this is a real need. Immigration is a huge issue in this country. And lots of times we address it without thinking about the other people that it affects, the children.
And I think like the thing is, of course you should complain. Of course you should write your congressperson, do all the things while you're trying to do what you can, if it's possible. And I think that's the thing. Instead of just doing one, I mean, throw yourself in there and do what you can to do good.
So it's inspiring. I think it's great. My wife has worked a lot of her life with a lot of people with illegal immigration and really has an empathy towards these people that come to the country seeking a better opportunity. So I'm glad you brought her up. It's an important issue. It's an important thing to think about. And I love thinking about how I should be helping and what I can do for people around me. And it's great to see when people step up and do it.
Yeah, Nora Sandigo. She's in our Hall of Fame. Respect.
Thanks, Steele. Now we're going to transition into something that is only slightly less important. This is Lost the Plot. Steele, I recently saw a film by the title of John Wick, and I knew that you would enjoy this film because it stars a certain Keanu Reeves.
Whoa.
Probably your favorite actor.
Yeah, no probably about it. Love the guy.
I'm just going to give you a couple details and you just go, but it's Keanu Reeves. He used to be an assassin with the mob, and now his wife just passed away. But she bought him a dog right before she died. And that's what I'm going to leave you with.
Okay, so this is a great film. I would recommend it for families. It's especially, it's a heartwarming story. It's a story of redemption. It's a story of rebuilding your life after tragedy. And it's a story of entrepreneurship as well. John Wick is the story of a guy who lived a horrible life. He used to be an assassin for the mob, killing people for a living. He fessed up to his crimes. He made a full confession, tried to do restitution. You can't bring people back from the dead, but he did everything he could to try. And one thing that happened after he served his prison term, his wife tragically fell ill and died. And all this happens before the film starts. But as a kind of a parting gift to him, his wife buys him a dog. And the dog, his name, this is really cute, his name is Candles. And John Wick realizes, this is the sign. My dog is named Candles. My name is John Wick. What we need to do is make a difference in the world. And he realizes that in many parts of the world, after dark, it's very, very dangerous. You can't see anything. Yeah. There's not reliable electricity. And so what he decides to do is to invent something that can help people get around in the dark, do things in the dark, in places where you don't have reliable electricity. And so he builds the world's first fireless candle.
Oh.
Names it after his dog, Candles. And it's actually a wickless candle, which is the irony, because his name is John Wick. So it's John Wick... John Wick's wickless candle. It's hard to say, but it's a super successful business idea. And the thing is, he starts making these candles, and the thing that blows everybody away is he doesn't sell them. He just gives them away.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And it
beautiful.
Starts causing problems because the big candle makers and the big electricity companies, they're like, who is this John Wick fellow? He's trying to crowd our market, you know? And so for a moment there, you think they're going to come after him and they're going to do some real harm. And in fact, a big bad guy even tries to get Candles into his van. And he drives like a block, two blocks away. And Candles is trapped in this van. And they've got him under a blanket. And you hear Candles. It's real sad. But the thing is, Candles is super smart. And he distracts him. And he's able to open the van door and jump out and run away. So, I mean, I don't want to spoil too much. But Candles makes it back home. And John Wick is like, Keanu is like, oh, buddy, I almost lost you. I'm so glad you're back. And Candles is licking his face, and John Wick's like, I'll never let the bad guys get you again. And so he puts a security system in his house, and Candles is safe. He keeps him inside most of the time after that. But the really interesting, I guess the most compelling part is the kind of final scene, because it isn't just a film about John Wick's wickless candles and his friendship with his dog. There's a lot more to it, Dave. Should I say more about what happens, or is that a spoiler?
But we'll just give the spoiler alert. Steele's going to spoil the ending, so if you don't want to hear it, just skip forward in the podcast. But let's go ahead and discuss it.
Yeah, so this is the cool part. What ends up happening is John Wick's wickless candles become so powerful and so important that the government realizes that the technology in them doesn't just replace like electricity and street lamps, but it can basically solve all of the human race's energy needs.
Wow.
So he solves global warming. And the reason that he does it is he's tinkering in the garage and he just can't. He's so close, but he can't figure it out. He's so close and he can't figure it out. And the thing is, Candles comes in and Candles has something in his mouth. And at first you can't see it and you're like, and Keanu's like, Candles, I'm working. And Candles goes, but is muffled because he's got something in his mouth. He's like, okay, it must be important, Candles. Come on over here. And he comes over, and Candles has in his mouth a picture of John Wick and his wife before she died.
Oh, no.
And then you see, like, Keanu's starting to tear up. You get a sad Keanu face for, like, 5 seconds. But then Candles brings the photo over, and he puts it on one of the parts that he needs and then carries it over and puts it on the other part that he needs. And all of a sudden, you see his face light up, and he's like, Thank you, candles. And then he puts the parts together and he figures out how to make renewable energy and electricity for the whole world for free, and he solves it. It's
All
like
thanks
heartwarming.
to the dog.
Yeah, candles.
Oh my gosh.
It was
That
such a good
is a
movie,
beautiful,
Dave.
uplifting film.
I loved it. I mean, thanks for recommending it. It was a real crowd pleaser.
Yeah, just like the real John Wick, only slightly different. I
Okay.
think they filmed two versions of the movie.
I must have seen the family version.
Yeah, that one was kind of the edited version, because
Okay.
in the version that I saw, some Russian mob dudes see John Wick driving in his fancy car. I don't know what he has. It's some kind of Mustang or something that's awesome.
Nice.
And he stops at the gas station and fills it up. He's getting over his wife's death. The only thing he has in his whole life to hold on to is this dog. He loves this dog because his wife gave it to him right before she died.
Is it
And
named? Is it Candles?
it is named Candles, actually. That was accurate.
Is it really?
I don't remember the dog's
Come
name.
on, Davey. I thought I really nailed that one.
So they John Wick drives home, but the Russians have seen this car and they want to buy it from him because it's such a cool car. And he's like, "The car's not for sale." But in the middle of the night, they break into his house. They can only break into his house because he was asleep. Like if he'd known they were coming or if he'd been awake, like he probably would have killed them all. But they break in, take the keys, beat him up, and right before they knock him unconscious, still,
No,
yeah.
no.
They kill the dog.
They
They
kill
kill Candles.
Candles. Dave, this movie sounds like a total revenge movie.
It is. Keanu goes crazy. The Russian kid, it's actually figures out it's the son of the mob boss that Keanu used to work for. And when the mob boss like figures out what his son's done, he's like, "Do you know what you've done? You killed Keanu's dog." Like he's gonna be super angry. And he calls Keanu and he's like, "Hey, can we work this out?" And Keanu's like, "Not without your son being dead."
That guy
And
pulls no punches.
so then it's on. He takes a sledgehammer. He has to crack the floor in his kitchen because that's where he's hidden all his guns. He gets all his guns out, and he's getting armed. He's ready.
Takes a sledgehammer to his kitchen floor.
Yeah, well, that's where you hide your guns. And all of a sudden, the mob boss sends this assassin team. There's like eight guys, and Keanu kills them all without like much of a much of a fight. Like just boom, like bullets right in the head. They just drop, like no issue. And a little bit of the comedy is he calls up this cleaning crew and says like, "I need eight suits picked up for dry cleaning," which is code for like, "Come take care of these eight dead bodies."
Wow. Well, I can't ask questions. This is just too hard. Tell me more.
So I'm not going to spoil the whole film for them like you spoiled your version, but rest assured, Keanu kills over 50 people in this movie. The son, he gets killed. Keanu gets him. He ends up killing everybody. And you know what? I am going to spoil the ending. So spoiler alert, because the ending's so good. He's all shot up. He's gotten away from this fight. He's killed everybody. He's killed the main boss. He's killed at least 50 guys, and he can barely drive his car, and he pretty much crashes it into a wall, but he gets out and he lays on the ground. He's holding his wounds, and you think he's gonna die, but he doesn't still. He gets up and he walks in this place, and it's an animal hospital.
And he gets a new dog.
He sews himself up and he looks around. He finds a new dog. There's hope for Keanu. He finds a new dog.
Wow.
He's gonna walk away.
That's a man who knows how to rebuild a life
Yeah.
and destroy lots of lives. Wow.
So
Wow.
I would highly recommend it to anyone that likes really, really violent Keanu Reeves movies. So that has lost the plot.
My version of John Wick was pretty good, you have to admit. I'm getting better at this.
No, it was beautiful. It was heart touching. It sounds like a Nicholas Sparks book almost.
Yeah, thanks.
So we're gonna move on still. We got a couple more things to do and we gotta wrap this up. But we got Unchained Melodies coming at you. So an artist that I really like is Andrew Bird. I love him. A number of years ago, we saw him open. I think it might have been for the Decemberists, and he just played by himself with just his violin, and it was terrific. He'll record loops on his violin so that his violin's accompanying him as he plays something else on his violin, and he'll sing, and it can get quite complex. And of course, he also plays with a full band. He plays guitar and stuff, but he's really known for his violin. He's terrific on it. And the last time he came to town, he had just released an album, and then he released an EP as well. I love the EP. It had more of like a old-timey feel to it, and I want to share one of the songs off of that called Three White Horses.
There'll be three white horses all in a line. There'll be three white horses in a line. Three white horses. When you go that way, you will need somebody when you come to die. Say goodbye. You're gonna miss her in the evening. You know we'll be needed somebody when you come to die.
So I really could have picked any number of Andrew Bird songs, and this one might not even be a characteristic song from him, but I still love it.
That guy is amazingly talented. You know the Pulaski at Night song?
Yes.
I've been listening to that obsessively the last couple of months. It's heartbreaking, man. That guy's gorgeous.
I love that song. He's just an interesting man. He seems to me like a much stranger than I could possibly imagine him being. He just seems like a weird guy, and I really like it.
Yeah. You know, Dave, here's the weirdest fact about him. Did you know what band he used to be in, like years and years ago?
I do. You're going to say Squirrel Nut Zippers.
Right? Isn't that crazy? It's so surprising to me.
It's great. The guy can produce any kind of music.
Totally.
And he does it well.
Totally, totally. So the song that I wanted to play actually has a connection to the Laura Sandiego or the Nora Sandiego thing from earlier. One of my favorite blues musicians is Mississippi John Hurt. He was awesome, just an awesome blues guy from Avalon, Deep Delta Blues. And he has a song called Here I Am, O Lord, Send Me.
Here I am. Well, here am I, Lord, send me. Oh, here am I, Lord, send me. Here am I, oh, Lord, send me. Don't you hear my Savior calling? Yes, who will go and work today? Yes, fields are ripe and harvest waiting. Well, who will bear the sheaves away? Here am I, oh Lord, send me. Well, here am I, Lord, send me. Oh, here am I, Lord, send me. Here am I, oh Lord, send me.
Yeah, I thought that was nice. I like the guitar work he's doing, the little finger picking. I just really like the sound he was getting from that guitar.
Definitely. He's a legend, man. You can't go wrong with Mississippi John Hurt. One of my favorite musicians of all time. So he's definitely an Unchained Melody. There's a version of this song that's fantastic. It's on a Mississippi John Hurt tribute album by a guy named Alvin Youngblood Hart. It's kind of a modern rockin', just soulful cover of it.
Today, the fields are ripe and harvest waiting. Who will bear the sheaves away? Hear my, oh Lord, send me. Hear my, hear my, oh Lord, send me.
The Steel. On previous episodes, I've shared the two other songs I sing to my girls for them to go to sleep, and this is the third one.
No way.
This is by Cat Power. It's the Color and the Kids. Do you know this? Do you know this song?
Dave, your kids are so lucky. This is really beautiful. I do know this song, and I love it.
I always start singing to them at the part where she talks about the beaches. So they always, when they're picking, they'll say, beach song, and we'll sing this one.
Will you meet me down on a sandy beach? We can roll up our jeans so the tide won't get us below.
I just love the melody. It's just beautiful. And I love to sing it to my girls. It's one of the happy things in life.
That's great, Dave. You know, one of my most enduring concert memories is actually Sean Marshall from Cat Power. I was in New York City. There was a Neil Young tribute concert in Prospect Park for free. And she came on and did a version of Mr. Soul. But the part I really remember was she came back later to do The Needle and the Damage Done. And she's got terrible stage fright. She's a wreck. But she sat there, no interaction before or after, and there was a cigarette dangling from her lips the whole time she performed as she sang the song. I was in awe. Mm-hmm. I don't know how that was even possible. And then she was just like out of there. I was like, whoa, that's a troubled person, but a beautiful voice. That's what I think of with Cat Power. But man, great song.
So what do you got for us, Steel?
Here's my last song. So this last weekend I watched the Disney animated version of Robin Hood again, one of my favorite childhood films. And I recently learned that the guy who plays the rooster and is the troubadour in the song was Roger Miller. His famous song was King of the Road.
Okay, yeah.
And so I didn't realize this, but a few months ago I started listening to this whole catalog. The guy's amazing. He sings some great, weird, awesome songs. So I'm going to play a little medley montage of three Roger Miller songs that are just off the chain. We're going to start with Oodawally, right, which you'll recognize. We'll get the whistle stop, and then we'll get a novelty song called Dang Me. So get ready for some Roger Miller.
I'm ready.
Robin Hood and Little John walking through the forest, laughing back and forth at what the other has to say. Reminiscing this and that and having such a good time. Oodle-lolly, golly, what a day. Oodle-lolly, golly, what a day. Well, here I sit a high, getting ideas. Ain't nothing but a fool to live like this. Out all night, running wild. Woman sitting home with a month-old child. Dang me, they ought to take a rope and hang me high from the highest tree. Woman, would you weep for me?
So yeah, Roger Miller. Who knew? That's amazing.
I've always loved his voice in that movie. It's fantastic, and it's all catchy, but his voice is just it's terrific.
And it's so warm and inviting. He just sounds like a character, like a lively, humorous dude.
Like I don't want to give him a hug, but I want to give him just a nice handshake. That's what I want.
I don't want him around in the room if I want to have a good time, but I want him to go home before evening falls because I don't know what he's going to do to the house.
That's Unchained Melodies for this week. We hope you enjoyed some of those songs. We're going to close out the episode today with book wisdom, and I believe that Steele is going to actually crack open the Bible for this one.
I am, Dave. So this is a reference to a couple things that came up today, and one was the idea of Nora Sandigo answering the call and saying, "Here I am." The idea of that, it's a Hebrew term or expression, hineni. And this is what Abraham says at a couple times in the story where God calls him to sacrifice his son. So I'm going to read that passage, which just wrecks me. This is Genesis chapter 22, verses 1 through 12. And I chose the passage from the NIV. Sometime later, God tested Abraham. He said to him, "Abraham, here I am," he replied. Then God said, "Take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on a mountain I will show you." Early the next morning, Abraham got up and loaded his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son, Isaac. When he had cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the place God had told him about. On the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. He said to his servants, "Stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We will worship, and then we will come back to you." Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and placed it on his son Isaac, and he himself carried the fire and the knife. As the two of them went on together, Isaac spoke up and said to his father, Abraham, "Father?" "Yes, my son," Abraham replied. "The fire and wood are here," Isaac said. "But where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" Abraham answered, "God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son." And the two of them went on together. When they reached the place God had told them about, Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then he reached out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven, "Abraham, Abraham, here I am," he replied. "Do not lay a hand on the boy," he said. "Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God, because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son."
Now, obviously, you know, from a Christian perspective, this is pointing towards God's sacrifice of his son, Christ. But when I read this passage now, the emotions that well up inside me are much closer related to my feelings for my children. I couldn't imagine having to go through this with one of my daughters. I couldn't do it. I'd have to tell God that we need a different plan here.
This is the story, and the thing that's so wrenching to me about this is so little is said. There's all the stuff that's between the lines, because Abraham is the same character that a couple chapters earlier, God's like, I'm going to destroy this city, and it's a city full of strangers, and Abraham bargains with God. He's like, no, if you can find just a few righteous people, will you save the city? And he bargains God down. That's the same character that just doesn't put up any argument here. He just goes and starts to do it. And the other thing that kills me about this story is the story says, take your son, your only son, whom you love. Like, it keeps qualifying this because Isaac is not Abraham's only son. He's got Ishmael too. And so it's like, God's just like hitting closer and closer and closer to his heart. So at first Abraham's like, take your son. He's like, all right, I'll pick Ishmael or whatever. And then he's like, your only son. And he's like, what do you mean? Whom you love. And it just gets him. You know, it has to. There's so much in that story.
I've been thinking recently about the nature of love to a certain extent. Listening to pop songs and music, so much of them are about like a romantic love. And I think that's good. I like romantic love. It's beautiful. But to me, the love that you have for your wife and for your children, I think it's a higher form of love, a different thing entirely that's very powerful, that enters your heart with that. It's a perfect love.
Hmm. Well, it's a love it's richer, it's more complex. Like, it's a love that's open to wounding, and it's willing to survive a wounding. You know, like, think about this story. Isaac is old enough and strong enough to carry the wood up the hill, and he ends up being bound on the altar. He has to have consented, because he could overpower his dad, you'd think. If he can carry the wood up the mountain, he's not a little kid. There's a bond there. There's a trust and a love. And then he realizes what his dad's going to do. And his dad's serious, like stretching out the arm. Like, how do you repair that relationship afterwards? But yet there's some kind of bonds there, that there's got to be some kind of psychic wounding there that happens that hopefully gets healed.
I guess the trust between father and son is beautiful. It's beautiful when I feel, you know, one of my daughters give that trust to me, that their day, their happiness that day, so much of what happens to them that day is up to me. And yeah, I'm grateful I get to be there to help that day be great.
It's crazy, Dave. I think that's the big thing that I've learned so much about becoming a father. Like in this story, there's layers of that relationship where Isaac is the one who knows the least about what's happening. And he sort of just has to trust that Abraham knows a bit more. And Abraham doesn't know that much about what's happening and has to trust that the angel or that God knows a little bit more in the big picture. I think about that with, like, my children. Like, I know very little about the world, but I know a little bit more than they do. And I think about, like, the role that my father played for me and still does. Like, when there's stuff I don't know about, if there's something breaks in our house and I need to fix it or whatever, my dad's who I call. And that for him, there was a father. And for him, there was a father and a mother. You know, like, there's this just chain of our ancestors in this role that we play the role of the smallest amount of knowledge, and then it grows, and then we play that role for someone else. You know, it's just, it's amazing, the generations unfolding like that.
Maybe I've shared this experience with you before, but my daughter Elsie, when she was a baby, she had torticollis, which basically means her neck was really tense and her head tended to go to one side more. Basically, the treatment for her was to stretch her 3 or 4 times a day. If you didn't do it, she may actually need surgery at some point, and the muscles in her neck would be so tight, you'd have to do something to release them. So so we stretched her, and she's just, you know, she's just an infant. She's 3 to 6 months at this time.
And it hurts, and she hates it. Ugh.
There's nothing in her life she hated more than having her neck stretched. And so like half the time I'm doing it, every time I do it, she's in tears, and half the time, like, tears are welling up in my eyes, and all I can do is say to her, Elsie, I know you hate this, but you have to trust me, because I know that this is for your good, and now her neck's fine, but it was months of stretching and her just being so angry. I think it's interesting that we always feel like we know what's best in our life at a time when I think many times we don't know what's actually the best thing for us. So we're always ready to kick and scream when sometimes we need to be prepared to just kind of accept what's happening.
I think that's been a huge lesson of parenting. There's a vulnerable being who can't express themselves, who's dependent on me and experiences discomfort or pain or whatever. And like so many of the times I want to take it away or fix it or change it, but I don't know that I can. And so like accepting a bad situation and trying to dwell in it in a way that you don't want to destroy yourself is a hard lesson. But one of the big lessons of parenting, because it's easy to laugh and have a great time when the baby's laughing and smiling. There's nothing easier than that. But there's mm-hmm. nothing harder than accepting that there is some kind of discomfort or suffering that you can't take away or fix. But you can, or you hopefully can, make it be not the only thing that fills your mind and your consciousness, because otherwise it just can't function.
Yeah, that's why parenthood, I think, is awesome. This kind of love, when you have it towards your wife, your child, or someone else, when your concern for them outweighs your concern for yourself, it makes life beautiful. Yeah. Even when that day is terrible, life is still much more beautiful.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I agree. You don't feel selfish at the end of the day, and that goes a long way to feel like, hey, I did something.
I think this is bringing to conclusion a very uneven episode of talking about aliens, then Nora Sandigo, then Lost the Plot, and then talking about sacrificing our children. But I enjoyed it still. Thanks for talking.
Me too. You know, there's that line from What Woman's Song and myself. He says, I am large. I contain multitudes. And that's what this episode was, Dave.
Terrific. Let's just keep making them.
Yeah.
Off the chain. Off the chain.
Hey, what are Mogwai? Are Mogwai from our planet, or are they from another planet?
I'm not sure what those are. I don't know if it's intelligent or we're going to probe my rectum, but I think it's out there.
I mean, if that was his own category, I would pick that. Mogwai. I changed my answer.
Mogwai. Thank you.
Yeah.